Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you?
Happy morning to you.
Happy morning. Were you trying to do something Irish?
No.
Mark generally gets me mad because he can't keep the Irish and the Scottish separate.
Top of the morning to you.
He doesn't get the both Celtic peoples. I'll grant you.
I do it specifically to tick you off. I'm glad that it works.
We have, as you know, for me and my family of crazy Irish Americans here in this country, the St. Patrick's Day season is a great season and a lot of getting together for meals and drinks and parades and stuff. In Ireland, oddly, my family's like, St. Patrick's Day? Like, what's the deal? Today off from school. It's not a big deal. But it's a big tradition here, and we have a lot of things around it in my family in the month of March. But there are a lot of Scottish folk or Scottish-American folk here in Jersey, and they have some food traditions of their own. They're no better than the Irish.
Equally disgusting.
And some of them. I think most Scottish and Irish food is not disgusting. However, there's one notable exception, which is haggis. And you may have heard of haggis, but haggis is the traditional meal that you must have on Robert Burns Day. Robert Burns, of course, was the famous Scottish poet. And he actually wrote a poem to haggis called Address to a Haggis, which starts, "Fair, fair, ya honest, sonsy face, great chieftain of the puddin' race."
Great, Francis. Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
It's not something.
So why don't you tell people how disgusting haggis really is?
It's not something to recite.
Okay, because I'll tell you, I love trying different foods. I'm really into, you know, using the whole animal for all sorts of stuff. Tell us what haggis is, please.
Okay, haggis is normally made with the offal of a sheep, and that's O-F-F-A-L, not A-W-F-U-L, uh-huh. Although it's debatable. But it's usually made with the heart and liver and lungs.
You know, I was okay with the liver.
Okay. The lungs.
And then the heart, I was kind of like, it's kind of gross. I don't really like the flavor of heart of most animals. And then you put the lungs in there because just to gross it up a little bit.
I'm not done. and you know how sometimes sausage is made in, well, it's in...
Animal casing.
Animal casing is a nice way to put that. but even less pleasant than what your sausage animal casing is usually... we take the heart, liver, and lungs of a sheep, and we put it in the stomach of the sheep and seal it all up in there good and then boil it for an hour.
Come on, and, you know, let's add a little... there's got to be something more disgusting we can put in there. Some toenails maybe we could put in there with that.
Stop! You're going to get hate mail from Irish people. If we get any tartan plaid
from
stationery,
people,
we'll know
yeah.
what it is. we don't even have to open it. Okay, so you boil it all in the sheep's stomach for an hour, because boiling is the Celtic cooking method of choice. And I can only imagine that makes it less flavorful, which is probably a good thing.
I can only imagine what it makes your kitchen smell like.
Well, here's the deal. Because of modern safety regulations in America, today, haggis here is made with less offal and more regular cuts. And I think there are no lungs allowed.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Hooray for modern cooking regulations.
There are no lungs allowed. And you can buy, just in case, just... this is sort of an endorsement, I guess. I don't think they pay for it. But we do a lot of business with Heritage Foods USA. You can find them online. You link them on our website. They're a sponsor of the show from time to time, and they come on occasionally. They're really into traditional foods, sustainably raised animals, humanely raised animals. Well, they have some haggis available for the season if you want to get it in time for Robert Burns Day. I don't quite know when that is, but it's soon.
And you're going, you know, we'll get it for you at Stage Left, but you're going to have to special order it.
Yeah.
Because there won't be any haggis laying around
our
restaurant.
Yeah, you won't find that as well. The ingredients are of the Heritage Foods version are beef shoulder, liver, oatmeal, salt, pepper, onions, cloves, and a beef suet, which is like the fat around the kidneys. And that's it. And we put it all in a stomach, and there we go.
Actually, you know what's different about that haggis than traditional haggis?
It's less disgusting than most.
It's actually food.
Yeah.
As opposed to...
Well, I'll tell you now.
Everything
here's
else.
The, here's the
do you
deal.
Stir the haggis with a bone? Is that what you do when you're stirring it? Big old
well,
femur. Here,
here's a letter from the guys over at Heritage Foods USA. They say, you know, do you know why haggis exists? One theory is that it was invented as a way of cooking the quick spoiling offal near the site of a hunt to feed the hunters as they brought their prey back home. Now, this is when you used to kill before refrigeration, you'd kill an animal. And then you'd have a feast, and you'd have a feast on the stuff that you couldn't preserve. I mean, everything else you could salt or cure or smoke or whatever, but the heart, liver, lungs, you had to eat that day or not at all, so that was considered a delicacy. Thank God they invented refrigeration.
You know, I've been joking about this a lot, but you know what? Foods like this are traditional foods, and they became traditional foods because it was important to eat all the parts of the animal. It was important to make sure that we... you know, respected the animal that we've just cooked for food or killed for food, and that we used it all.
Look, I've been at Mario Batali's place,
uh-huh.
and the Italians and the French do a heck of a lot better job with this stuff. Okay, because if you want me to eat the heart and the lungs, I'll trust Mario Batali. I'll trust your French grandmother or your Italian grandmother. But the Scottish guy, listen, not at all. Now here's the question though: what is the appropriate drink to accompany haggis? They ask, and they suggest sparkling wine, what, or Scottish whiskey? Yes.
Okay, I have a great idea. Actually, if you're gonna have haggis, have a lot of Scottish whiskey first, and then have the haggis.
No, have a lot of Scottish whiskey first. Choke it down with some Scottish whiskey, and then have Scottish whiskey and a cigar after and try and forget what you've eaten. All right, so haggis, sorry, all the Scottish-hate mail can come in now. Kearney, the entire city of Kearney is
If you've
us.
Had good haggis, please feel free to email me and tell me, but I don't believe you.
Here's news from the Associated Press. More men are taking up cooking. Men are very surprising in the kitchen, they say. The real cooks, the passionate cooks, and the ones who are going to do the pig roast, for example, are going to find the box to cook it and dig the pit. These people are usually men. This is from Dana Cowan, the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine magazine, who was on our show before. It used to be that men were were concerned about their prowess in barbecuing, but now it's also, I want to show you the prowess of my sauces. And finally, 10 years ago at Men's Health magazine, publication was known for workout routines, sex advice, and cover shots of buff guys. Recipes were among the least read stories and were sometimes left out entirely. Now, at Men's Health magazine, recipes are, check this out, the most read stories in the magazine.
Interesting.
Men are cooking in the kitchen. I mean, look at our friends get together.
Absolutely.
I have to say, some of our friends are like, oh, Mark and Francis are coming? I'm not cooking. Going out now.
What are you bringing?
Exactly. Well, I was like, I
that
love
sounds fair. I'll tell you, Francis and I realize that when we go to home or for a home cooked meal, that's exactly what we're going for.
Absolutely.
And stop worrying about it so much. Okay. So all of my friends who are out there listening, don't worry about cooking for me. Don't be afraid to just make something simple and something easy and something that you've done 1,000 times so you don't mess it up.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:50. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Ian Ball. Ian was born in Britain, but he has moved to India. He was food and drink editor of Time Out Mumbai. He is now consulting on Time Out Delhi, and he joins us from his home in the Goa province of India.
Ian, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
That's quite a well-traveled pedigree. I didn't know there was a Time Out Mumbai.
Yeah, I started about 2 years ago.
Can I ask a question? How would Time Out Mumbai be different than Time Out New York, let's say?
Well, I mean, it's obviously modeled on the Time Out that Time Out franchise, which is the same in London and New York and Chicago, and I mean it follows the same pattern, but it does have a very distinctly kind of Indian feel, and because Mumbai is a city that, I mean, there's tremendous things happening in Mumbai now. I mean, since the liberalization in the 90s, I mean, there's so many new restaurants and bars and nightclubs. But it's also a city with huge challenges. So the magazine tries to kind of like cover both the excitement of living in this kind of growing economy, but also like the terrible problems, you know, with 60% of the population living in slums and pollution and corrupt governance. So it's kind of like it's kind of different in that sense from the other timeouts.
Might a story that's in Time Out New York or a piece of gossip that's in Time Out New York appear in Time Out Mumbai?
Yeah, we do occasionally carry Time Out New York stories, yeah. It might be a travel story, usually. So it's not necessarily directly related to what's happening in New York. But, yeah, occasionally we did carry a story called Da Rules, which was about how to behave like a New Yorker if you're traveling to New York.
Just for those of you in our listening audience who may not be familiar with Time Out, the Time Out series, there's Time Out New York, there's a Time Out London, there's a Time Out is a series of magazines, very important magazine for New York. It comes out weekly, it's very current, and it's used by both people in the city to see what's going on every week in theater, arts, dining, and it's shopping. And it's also a very valuable travel guide if you're going to a city that has a Time Out franchise and you're going to go there. If you can get your hands on one, you can find some cool stuff. How is it used in Mumbai, and you're working on a project, I understand, in Delhi? Is it used mostly for Delhians and natives of Mumbai, or is it used as a travel magazine?
Yeah, no, it's very much aimed at the locals. I mean, it's kind of, you know, there'll be cultural references that, I mean, you might not necessarily get if you're a visitor. I mean, although it is supposed to be, it's kind of user-friendly for visitors as well. But, yeah, it's very much aimed at locals, and it's about kind of helping them to kind of explore their own city and discover things that maybe they didn't know about their own city, which is really needed in a city like Mumbai where people kind of like, you know, it's not a user-friendly place to live. So, you know, that kind of magazine really does help.
So, you were the drinks editor for Time Out. What kind of cocktail scene is happening in Mumbai as we speak?
Well, cocktail scene is really, cocktails are extremely popular now. I mean, what's happened in the last sort of 10 years really is that in the food and drink scene in Bombay is that it's two things have happened really. One is that it's moved out of the five-star hotels into new standalone venues, bars and restaurants. I mean, before it was very much just like, you know, for the wealthy, and then we go to the five-star hotels and eat in the restaurants there. And the other thing that happened is just like an explosion of new imports, so you get all kinds of new drinks that you didn't have before. And the biggest thing really is not cocktails, but wines, because Indian wine is also taking off in a big way. There's a huge vineyard called Sula, which is based in Maharashtra, which is the same state that Bombay is in.
We had the owner of Sula Vineyards on the show.
Really? Did
yeah,
you? Okay.
And we carry all the way across where we carry Sula wines at our restaurant.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, great wine.
The world just gets smaller and smaller, doesn't it? Hey, let me ask you, Ian, one of the things that we're finding in New York, and I think that in some ways New York is a user-friendly city and in some ways it's not, but more and more I think it's a user-friendly city. And one of the ways people are rebelling against that is what we're seeing in New York is the sort of on the down low kind of cocktail place, which, you know, doesn't have a marked door. You have to know the phone number because they really don't want to be mobbed. Do you have the same sort of cool, like, you got to know it to be able to get there thing going on in Mumbai?
No, not really, not yet.
Is the problem in Mumbai that you can't find it anyway and you need, you know, they desperately want people to find it? Is that the situation?
Because the scene has been sort of historically so limited, you know, it's like now, there are so many people now with like much higher disposable incomes, and they want places to go out and spend spend their money and have a great time, go out and drink and eat. So, yeah, no, that is absolutely, I mean, I think we've got a long way to go before we get to that kind of, like, we want to kind of hide ourselves away and to be cool. I mean, right now it's like, you know, they want to let you know where they are.
And want to be seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much of that kind of scene in Bombay. It's very much a kind of see and be seen, and which is part of the kind of the culture of the city as well, which is kind of like to be kind of showy and kind of flashy. You know, you go out to be seen having a good time in these kind of cool places.
And is there quite the nightlife? You know, dancing, drinking, sort of, you know, cosmopolitan city nightlife.
Carousing is really what Francis
Carousing.
Is looking
well,
for.
Was one of my favorite things to do, actually. But is there that sort of scene in Mumbai now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously you have to kind of put it in context, which is you've got a city of about 13 million people, and out of that, the kind of people who are going out to nightclubs and bars and restaurants is a tiny percentage of that. That's kind of like the creamy, the top layer. But, I mean, that's a big layer.
Well, sir,
in terms of numbers. Huh?
13 million people, you know, a few million here, a few million there. Sooner or later, they add up, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Ian Ball about India, about the cultural life in India, and we're also going to be talking about the cuisine of the province in which he lives, Goa, the Goan cuisine. You've heard Floyd Cardos come on the show and talk about a Goan chef cooking in New York, and we're going to talk about Goan cuisine in Goa in just a moment with Ian Ball. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're talking all the way to India today to Ian Ball, who is the who works with Time Out Mumbai and is working on a project with Time Out Delhi, the cool magazines. Now, I think a lot of people around here do like to travel, and they're often food and wine and cocktail-driven people. Is Mumbai and is Delhi, are these places for an English speaker that are friendly places that I could go pick out Time Out Mumbai and plan kind of a cool week of carousing?
Yeah,
do I need to know somebody locally to really help me out?
Well, obviously that always helps, but I mean, I think it is possible in Mumbai. Delhi is, it's also possible. I think Mumbai really, and I'm kind of biased because I love Mumbai, but I mean, that Mumbai is really the party capital of India, has to be said. And yeah, you could spend a whole week just, I mean, people love to party in Mumbai. And you could there's so much happening there now, you could easily spend a week like going to different places, checking out different scenes in different parts of the city.
And English
and have a good time.
And English is no problem. Everything
oh,
is
Oh yeah,
English,
I mean English is very, very common. Yeah. It's like it's pretty much a universal language, but especially in a city like Bombay, which is very cosmopolitan city, so you've got communities from all over India, so English and Hindi, but mainly English is like kind of the lingua franca for the city.
I think the Americans, and obviously British, I think sometimes we don't realize how lucky we have it that nearly every great city in the world has a plethora of English speakers and people you can communicate at the very least because there's going to be somebody there who has some, you know, English speaking ability.
Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing is in India, like, I guess you... the figures kind of vary, but I think out of the population of a billion people now in India, you have something like 50 million English speakers. And I don't just mean people who kind of like have a passing familiarity with English, but people who, you know, speak it at home and they speak with their friends. Like, it's their kind of native tongue, really, in a way.
Well, if you want to find out how to access this and maybe how to get over there, you should check out Time Out Mumbai and the forthcoming Time Out Delhi. Ian Ball is a consulting editor on both of those publications, and he said, because we're going to take him very literally, that it's important to know somebody in those cities. If you want to visit, we're going to give you his cell phone number after the news. And no, we're not, actually, but we're going to be talking not just about the social scene out there, but we're also going to be talking about the cuisine of Goa, and there are actually a lot of Goan spices that you can find here in New York to work into your own cuisine. We'll be talking more about that after the news, so stick around. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Ian Ball. He was born in Britain, but now he lives in India. We're talking to him from his home in the Goa province of India. He was food and drinks editor of Time Out Mumbai, and he's now a consulting editor on Time Out Delhi. We were talking before the break about Mumbai, Time Out Delhi, Time Out Mumbai, which are related to the Time Out New York magazine, Time Out London magazine. To be fair, we got a couple of calls over the news, and we will link you to those sites and to learn more about Ian on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. If you want to visit Mumbai, I suggest consulting those resources. But we're going to turn the conversation now with Ian to we first came across your writing about Goa in an article in Bon Appetit magazine on the cuisine of Goa, which is a province of India. Why don't you tell us how Goan cuisine is different than or how is unique among the many cuisines of India?
Of India, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you said, there are many, but it is kind of special, and the reason is really boils down to the influence of the Portuguese who colonized Goa in the early 16th century. And when they came, they introduced not only their own cuisine, but the cuisines of colonies and other places that they visited across sort of Africa, Asia, and South America. So basically what's happened in the last sort of 500 years, I mean, the Portuguese stayed for until 1961 is when they finally got booted out by the Indian Army. And but over that time, I mean, it was like a huge mixing bowl, and all these influences and ingredients from pretty much all over the planet got mixed up in Goa, and it became this. So there was you ended up with this kind of really kind of unique fusion cuisine that has all these different mixes.
I think one of the interesting things about Goan cuisine for an American or a Western European is because the Portuguese had such an influence, there are recognizable Western European things like, you know, olive oils and vinegars and sausages.
Yeah.
And things like that.
I think things we as Americans wouldn't necessarily expect to see in Indian cuisine.
Is that
the
case?
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. Like things like, vinegar is, that's a very distinctive part of the Portuguese influence. And like you say, Goan sausages, which are these, I mean, it's basically the Iberian sausage, but with like much more chilies and vinegar than they would normally have in Portugal. So it's really something on its own. But what's interesting is that the Portuguese didn't just influence Goan cuisine. They pretty much transformed Indian cuisine as a whole, I mean, Indian food as a whole, because they introduced the chili from South America. And the main spice before they came was black pepper, which was common in South India. So now the chili, you can't imagine Indian food without chilies, and that's really thanks to the Portuguese. And they also brought things like, potatoes, tomatoes, pumpkins, guavas and pineapples. I mean, all these kind of things that you now would, like, take for granted in an Indian market.
Do we know what Goan cuisine was like or Indian cuisine was like before the Portuguese?
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's very difficult to know. I mean, I've really tried to sort of find out what were Goans eating, you know, in the 15th century before the Portuguese showed up. It's very difficult to know because it's difficult to imagine it. I mean, we can imagine that there was a strong black pepper influence, but really, it's very difficult to put your finger on it because there are kind of two distinct sub-cuisines in Goa, which is kind of loosely follow the kind of the Catholic Goan tradition and the Hindu Goan tradition, and the difference is the Catholic is much closer to the Portuguese. In the sense, it has a large use of vinegar and uses pork and things like that, which of course a Hindu would never eat pork or beef. So, but even if you look at the Hindu Goan cuisine now that's available in Goa now, which is not widely available in restaurants, you have to kind of seek it out in a couple of good places in Goa. Even that is very different from what it was because the chili is now a major part of that cuisine. So what it was before the chili came is really difficult to know. So well, those tastes have kind of died out, I'm afraid.
And there are chilies indigenous to India. They're just not nearly as spicy as the chilies that were brought in.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is, I mean, you write in the article about how, it's related in the article about how in authentic Goan cuisine, restaurants that serve authentic Goan cuisine, they're wary of serving foreigners, Western Europeans, you know, chilies, too intense chilies. They sort of dumb it down for foreigners.
Because we're kind of wimps.
Yeah.
is really the bottom line, isn't it?
Is that the case? I mean, is authentic too hot for most Western Europeans, or just the British? I'm Irish. It's the
actually,
same thing.
You know, that's kind of unfair because the Brits, I mean, now, you know, I mean, they love Indian food. And they've got basically North Indian food is what they think of as Indian food. And they, you know, they love going out, having a few pints, and then going to the local curry house and waking up the next morning with very kind of sore stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, chili, yeah, I mean, I would say in general, I guess, yeah, if you're coming from the U.S. or from Europe, you would have to kind of watch it. I mean, I used to be a complete wimp when it came to any kind of spicy food. But like, you do adapt, and now I can't tell anymore whether something is too spicy. If I have a friend coming over from the UK, I can no longer tell whether or not this is going to be too spicy, because for me it tastes fine, and then I kind of realize they're turning red, and so yeah,
sweating.
And I think.
And you're like, is that sweat on your forehead? Would you like a napkin?
But that's like that's true of a lot of different spices and even salt and things like that. The more you eat, the more you become desensitized to them.
Yeah.
And thereby less able to judge. I mean, one of the things that we have to be careful with our chefs is that they don't become impervious to salt, because
mm-hmm.
they taste every day.
Because they're tasting so many things with salt in them every day. They have to kind of tone it down on certain things, because the average American does not eat as much salt as the average chef.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's certain pride, the pride that you have, that you can now have this food and your friends from home, when they come over, they wilt on the table?
Yeah, that's true. It's silly, isn't it? But
it's a manly thing.
To admit to it. I blame my fiance, who's from Bombay. I mean, she kind of, when we first met, she started cooking for me, and I think she was sort of testing me to see how mm-hmm. far I could go, you know,
mm-hmm.
and like, I had to kind of prove to her that I was worthy by consuming huge quantities of chilies.
She is your fiance, so you've passed the test, evidently. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's right. We're getting married on March 3rd. So
that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, and you're going to honeymoon in New Jersey and come to Stage Left Restaurant, where we're going to...
Okay,
yeah?
Good.
Well, we'll see.
Okay,
that's it. Thank you for humoring me on the radio. Let me ask you, if an American who doesn't know anything about Goan cuisine were to go to Goa and have something and say, listen, Ian, I got your cell phone number from the Restaurant Guys Radio. Take me to a restaurant and show me a traditional Goan dish that's going to surprise me that I haven't seen before. What would it be?
Okay, well, I guess you would have to go to a place called Mum's Kitchen, which actually I did write about in Bon Appetit. There's a restaurant in Panjim, which is the capital city, called Mum's Kitchen, which is a really interesting restaurant because they are trying to sort of, well, they say their mission is to preserve Goan cuisine, because in most restaurants you will only find what I call the so-called Catholic Goan tradition of food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very much like kind of the heavily Portuguese influenced food. But this restaurant also serves Hindu Goan food, the food from that is generally called from the Hindu Goan tradition, and they have like a network of mothers, what they call their mothers across Goa, who give them kind of homemade recipes. So you can get all kinds of interesting stuff there. And if you were to come kind of just before the monsoon or just after the monsoon, you'd be able to get ladyfish, which is a fantastic kind of local fish, which is generally you'd have it fried in semolina, a very light, crisp coating of semolina, which is delicious.
It's a fish I've never heard of. Tell us about it.
Right. Okay. I mean, it's basically it's a river fish. I mean, it's local to what do they call it here? They call it I forgot my one name. But it's a white fish. It's a very soft flesh. And it's delicious. It's very simple. And it's very simply prepared. I mean, you might have a little bit of red chili and turmeric powder. On the skin, and then coated in semolina, and then fried, and that's it.
Is the Hindu Goan cuisine more spicy or less spicy than the Catholic cuisine?
Less, I'd say less spicy. Yeah, it's less rich, really, less oily.
We're going to link you, if you're interested in this stuff, and I suggest that you should be interested in this stuff, we're going to link you to this wonderful article that Ian wrote for Bon Appetit. It's up online right now, and you can go to Restaurant Guys Radio and find out about it. And you can also, if you're interested in Goan cuisine, check out the Floyd Cardo's interview, and he's cooking at Tabla in New York City. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little more with Ian about what to drink that's Indian influence, and that's more and more interesting every day. So hang around. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're talking with Ian Ball of Time Out Mumbai and Time Out Delhi from his home in the Goa province of India. We were talking about the bar scene in Mumbai where people should go and visit. We were talking about Goan cuisine, which is a very specific type of one of the specific cuisines of India that's very exciting. But we haven't talked much about beverage. We know that in India now, we had the owner of Sula Vineyards on, who makers of Indian wine, very interesting how they make wine in India. We'll talk about that in a second. But there, other than wine, there are other native Indian drinks. Why don't you tell us about Feni, which you wrote about?
Yeah. Feni is a you know, again, this came about after the Portuguese arrived because they brought cashews with them. It's made mainly from cashew fruit. Although there is a coconut variety, but, you know, purists consider it not to be really the real feni.
Can you tell everybody what cashew fruit is exactly?
Cashew fruit, yeah. I mean, they're basically cashew on cashew trees, grow cashew fruits, and they look basically like big yellow apples. And from the bottom of the fruit grows the nut, which kind of comes out like a hook. And to make feni, you harvest these apples, and it's made in this very kind of traditional way, which is to just carve out a kind of basin out of the rock, and you pile up these cashew fruits, and you get a guy in Wellington boots, and he stamps on them until all the juice comes out.
Very clean Wellington boots.
Yeah, that's right, very clean.
Well, not that clean.
I've seen it happen. It doesn't actually look terribly hygienic, I have to say, but, I mean, it all gets, like, distilled down, so I mean, it's pretty safe. But, the fruit, the juice comes out and into a big, taken in a big plastic bucket, and they basically distill it twice. And it becomes a really actually fantastic kind of strong spirit. And it's a white spirit with a very fruity kind of aroma of the cashew.
Is it sweet at all, or is it just spirituous and like an eau de vie?
No, it's kind of similar. I mean, no, it's not sweet at all. I mean, it's really like a kind of a... it's kind of like a, I don't know, like a whiskey or a vodka or something. I mean, it's like, when you get a really good feni, it's very, very smooth, but very strong. I mean, it's probably about 40% alcohol.
No, can you get it outside of India?
I have never seen it, I have to admit.
Well, you are the editor.
And you can't even get it outside of Goa, in fact, in India.
I was going to say, and you are the editor of Time Out Mumbai, so if you haven't seen it, I'm guessing that most of us aren't going to find it.
What? I mean, there's maybe one restaurant in Mumbai where they'll serve it, and that's about it. I mean, you can't buy it in the shops because it's kind of illegal to transport it across state lines.
And do you drink it? You drink it neat like a whiskey, or you drink it chilled like a martini? How do you drink it?
Yeah, you would drink it. I mean, you can drink it in a couple of ways. I mean, you would just drink it neat mainly, or you would drink it with. You would add some lime juice to it, or you know, it's not really the correct way to drink it, or you could drink it with kind of lemonade or something like that and just mix it.
Now, Francis and I are always fascinated when we find an alcohol that we've never heard of before.
It's worth a trip to Goa. Now, if someone if one of our listeners were to want to go and visit Goa, how would they go about doing it? What should they? Where should they visit? Where should they fly into? How long does it take? Where should they stay?
Right, yeah. Okay, I mean, if you're coming from the U.S., I guess your main thing would have to... I mean, I don't think you have any charter flights from the U.S., so I guess you have to fly to Mumbai, which is the nearest main city, and then get a connecting flight, which is pretty simple to do. There are huge numbers of new airlines now flying between Mumbai and Goa, and it's about a 45-minute flight.
45 minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So when I get to... Now, there's the province of Goa, and there's old Goa City, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Gore itself is a state, you know, in the union of the Indian Union. It's very small. It's one of the smallest states. I think it may be the smallest. It's got a population of about 1.3 million people. So, I mean, the population is a billion. So you can imagine how tiny that is. And in that you have the city of Old Goa, which is a really amazing. Do you want to know the story of Old Goa? I mean,
please.
It's pretty.
We've only got a couple of minutes, but I'd love the quick version.
I mean, basically, it used to be a huge sprawling metropolis in the 16th century when the Portuguese came. It became a huge trading station. And you hear stories that it was apparently as grand as London or Paris at the time, and it was mainly a trading port for horses and jewels and gold, and unfortunately slaves as well. Slavery was a huge part of the market here. And but it was wiped out by plagues, and all that's left now is some stunning churches that the Portuguese left behind.
That's amazing. Now, yeah. Are there places to stay in? Is it a very friendly place to find a hotel and stay and eat? And
mm-hmm, yeah, it's very easy. I mean, it really is actually a beautiful place for tourists to come because, I mean, the people here are innately warm, and I mean, the main place for tourists to come is the North Goa part, and it's the coastal strip. Although the downside of that is it's really very busy now. You've got a lot of tourists coming from Israel, Russia, Britain, Italy, and Germany. And so it's very, very crowded in the high season, which is mainly between kind of November, mainly December to March.
Most of our listeners travel to Western Europe for the most part. Is it an expensive city to travel to?
I'm sorry.
Most of our listeners travel to Western Europe normally. Is it an expensive place to visit?
Is Goa expensive comparative to Western Europe?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, it's probably one of the cheapest places you could go and stay at.
It's just a matter of you pay to get there, and then when you're there, it's your dollar can buy a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the main expense will be getting here. And then once you get here, your holiday will be pretty cheap. I mean, you can find nice places to stay that are relatively inexpensive. You can stay in fantastic places for $100 maximum, really, a night for two. There are more expensive places than that, but you don't need to spend that much to have a really nice stay.
In New York City, you can do that, but you got to stay with your brother, Bill. That's really like the only thing.
Hey, Ian, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. You've been a wonderful guest. Thank you for taking the time out of your schedule. At New York, it's 9 o'clock at night there, right?
Yeah, it's actually now, it's gone 10 now.
Oh, well, thank you again for talking to us so late from your home. It's been really swell. We're going to link you out there in listener land to the article in Bon Appetit magazine, to Time Out Mumbai, to Time Out Delhi, and you can read more of Ian Ball's work in several publications. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left and captain of the Bardi Restaurant, Sandy Brunswick. That guy was great.
Yeah, he was terrific. Well, you know, he's got such a different frame of reference. He spent most of his life in Britain, and then now he spent the last 4 years in Mumbai and in Goa. And just some really interesting commentary on places, frankly, Francis and I just don't know that much about.
You didn't hear that over the break we were saying goodbye to Ian, and he told us that we were like, how did you wind up? What made you decide to go to Mumbai? And he followed his fiance to Mumbai, and he's going to get married on the 5th of March. And I think that she had lived in America and Britain, and then she wanted to move back, and so we went there. I think that's great.
It is a great reason to travel, for sure.
Yeah. Your wife's family was originally from Tennessee, Mark. You headed out.
My wife's family is originally from Ohio, and I'm not going. Okay, and it was a great reason to travel away from Ohio.
You were a great reason for her to travel. I would say that you'd sooner follow your wife to Mumbai than go to Ohio. Is that not correct?
That may be true.
If you were interested in this stuff at all, I think it's a great destination, and it's not out of the question for me, especially any city that has a timeout, like Timeout Mumbai or Timeout Delhi, I would travel to.
You know, both Francis and I have had the good fortune in our lives to travel to kind of far away places that aren't necessarily heavily
on
touristed.
The beaten path. We're not on
off,
the beaten path.
Off the beaten path, certainly for Americans.
But always in Western world.
And it's, well, no, not always.
Oh, you,
in Western,
that's right, you're right. Yeah, I went to Africa and you went
sure.
to, I forgot. I did.
But I spent some time in Egypt, and Francis spent some time in Morocco, and some really interesting, some of the most interesting experiences of my life come from traveling kind of outside of that Western European norm that we're all used to traveling in. I mean, that's the, you know, you go to Paris, you go to London, you go to, I guess you go to Dublin. Normal people.
Yes,
normal people go to nicer cities than that.
Wow. That's harsh.
Just kidding.
Of course you're just kidding. I'll take you one day to Dublin. Well, anyway, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, I can't recommend highly enough Tablo Restaurant. Floyd Cardos, who was on the show, you can listen to it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You can also try Sula Wines. Also, they were on our show, S-U-L-A, Sula Wines. You can check that anytime. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Shaw.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.